Okay, here we
Okay.
are.
Hello, this is
This conference is being recorded.
our seventh meeting with the group of Practical Work on Self, and we're here tonight to discuss last week's chapter, The Struggle of Sorcerers, and then to move on to next week's chapter, The Search for Dr. Livingstone.
All right.
Welcome everyone who's here, and of course you can mute and unmute on the phone call anytime you like by using star six to both mute and unmute.
Okay.
Would you
Good
like me
stuff.
to read the heading of the chapter, or are you going to dive
Yeah,
in?
I'd like you to start with the reading of the Struggle of the Sorcerer's header, if you would, please.
All right. Ordinarily, the war of the forces of darkness and light just happens mechanically within the machine. It is uncontrolled and wasted. We must find a way to organize it and make it profitable to our work. So, how do we organize and make our struggle between the forces of darkness and light profitable to our inner work, our spiritual work?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that we talked about last time was that there appears to be, when we're looking at this chapter, we're focusing on the idea that there seems to be like an ongoing battle between the force of darkness or the prince of darkness and the prince of light, is how it was phrased in the chapter, that there's a battle going on, as is indicated in the header. It's a war, but it's a war that generally happens so mechanically that in a certain way we don't even know the war is going on. The war just continues, and one side seems to be winning all the time, or not. And if I remember correctly, a few people came up with some interesting ideas on how to characterize both the Prince of Darkness and the Prince of Light. And do we remember that, or do we want to get into that a little bit first, just as a reminder, as we get to maybe our experiences with the chapter? That was an important point, I think.
Which was an important point?
Well, how we characterize the idea of the Prince of Darkness and the Prince of Light. And if I remember correctly, there was something that even I thought you liked quite a bit about how to characterize the Prince of Darkness.
I'm characterizing the Prince of Darkness as the Prince of Light. As the part of oneself, and we tend to pick one or the other that fits with our personality, that is very much interested in the conscious mind and what we know, what we can see. And I use the example of people who are very much on a religious path, in traditional religious path, and may not be willing to really consider the shadow elements and really want to think that whatever they think in their conscious mind is the truth. And I was seeing the Prince of Light is that tendency to move toward consciousness and to identify with that. And the Prince of Darkness being more the movement into the unknown and into exploration, into wonder, and that whole exploration of the unconscious as much as possible in terms of the thrust of our work. And if I remember correctly, Silverdale was talking about the Prince of Darkness and the Prince of Light in more traditional terms, in terms of the three forces, and I cannot I cannot right away remember that word for word right now.
There was some characterization of as the personality, the how we looked at it. And then there was the non-phenomenal self.
That's right.
Gee, David, do you guys want me to read my notes from last week? Would that
Please.
help?
Yeah, that, well, yeah, I want to come back to the care. There was a term that Silverdale used, but in addition to that, and Diana has the notes on the these three stages that Silverdale introduced, which are also extremely interesting. Please, Diana.
Yeah, and Silverdale, jump in if I wrote this down incorrectly. It looks like, yeah, he was talking about a trinity. The first being what you all were saying, the historical personality, the Prince of Darkness.
There you go.
The second being our spirit, our lightness. Our objective is to make the light the dominant force. And I believe the third phase, the third prong, was blending and harmonizing the first two.
Yes. Yeah. Go ahead. And what did so the idea? What was the phrase? The primitive personality, or
Historical personality.
so the historical personality? And what is the historical personality, and how does it manifest in us as we go through our day? The historical personality then is the fundamental, in a sense, the fundamental sleeping machine. And this is just, that's what we learned. In a sense, as we talked about last week, that's how we found ourselves. We find ourselves in whatever position we find ourselves, and thank God we find ourselves with that opportunity. So we find ourselves enrobed, in a sense, in this historical personality. And every once in a while, something happens. And what's phase two again? Just read that.
It was the light, our spirit. It was the lightness. It seemed he, something. His objective was like to make the light the dominant force. That seemed to be the second prong.
Okay, so there's something else happens, and we call that the light. And that something else kind of glimmers through every once in a while. Now, we're talking about finding this out for ourselves here. This is not a philosophy class. This is a practicum. That's why the book is called, and that's why we're actually inspired by Teresa to do this class again. It's called Practical Work on Self. Practical. So we're trying to discover these, you can call them philosophic principles, but we're getting hints from people like Silverdale, from EJ. We're getting hints as to where to look, how to look. And we're finding this primitive personality then, blasting away however it does. And then here comes these hints, the Prince of Light. Now, I call that sometimes the non-phenomenal self, and it has the will of attention comes to bear. Okay, and go ahead. Oh, I say anti-me, anti-me. Yeah. Yeah, that was another work phase that happened some time ago. But
Can you say what this is for the people who don't know? The qu There's a question from Sinhog. The question is, does this that you're speaking about right now equate with the Antami yoga idea? So what are we talking about here?
I don't really remember that. That's what how that was characterized when it came up. If someone can help, I'll be able to grab it, but
Sinhok says, never mind, this is off topic.
Okay.
Or if this is off topic.
It'll cycle back in, Robert. It'll come back and we'll grab it. It'll be just a couple of minutes or someone will give me a hint as to that particular slant of anti-me. And in fact, it might be better posed in our next chapter as we get to chapter 7. But let's go back to this idea. We have this war going on again of the historical personality and this Prince of Light, this Prince of Light that we find ourselves, and on we go, on forward we go. So there's something called a war. What is the war that's going on? Does anybody have a feel for that? What's the war that he's even referring to here?
It's, in my mind, the struggle between the urge to awaken and the will to awaken and the will to remain asleep.
Let's look at that for a minute. The urge, the will, the urge, the we're compelled, the desire, the hint or something to awaken. So something happens that we're called forth in a sense to do that. And there's this urge to awaken. And what happens to that urge to awaken? Duh, we forget about it. And we just forget that we had that urge. But for some reason, it's a memory that we can't quite shake, is it? Once you start down the path, it's a memory, quote unquote, I'm using the word memory, you can't quite shake it. So because as long as it's there, there's this kind of this urge going on to go to sleep again and live from the basis of the primitive personality once again and just operate from there.
What do you mean by primitive personality?
Once again, I think I like the terminology that came out as the sleeping machine. It's the sleeping machine, our body of habits. It's how we have decided, or how we think that this is how we go through life. This is how you survive. This is what's available.
Okay.
And it's unconscious. It's reactive. We learned on a few chapters ago that most of our emotions really aren't an emotion, but rather a reaction to something we see and a derivation of what we believe that action or series of actions to be. So here we are caught in that interplay between these two forces.
Okay, now Silverdale said, Gurdjieff calls it the lawful refusal to submit to a diametrically opposite force. This is necessary to maintain the tension necessary to create support and maintain a, quote, universe, personal or cosmic. For this reason, the historical personality, living sequentially, refuses to submit to the non-phenomenal essence, which lives spherically. Nice.
Hey, T, would you mind reading that again?
I wanted to. Gurdjieff calls it the lawful refusal to submit to a diametrically opposite force. This is necessary to maintain the tension necessary to create support and maintain a universe, personal or cosmic. For this reason, the historical personality, living sequentially, refuses to submit to the non-phenomenal essence, which lives spherically. And in keeping with that, Mayor Babas said, if I can get it right, the creation of love is sustained. That's not quite right, but the creation of love is sustained by the tension of duality. So we're talking about the diametrically opposing forces creating a tension that is a creative tension that supports, maintains a universe, or in Mayor Baba's quote, love. And the tension between being the part of us that lives sequentially, the historic part, and the part of us that's non-phenomenal, which lives spherically outside of time, those parts need to be in the right relationship to one another to sustain that creative tension.
And to just comment on Mayor Baba, we're talking about the tension between the lover and the beloved. And I don't know if we brought that book, this course yet, but, you know, from the Spanish mystic. But this, the longing for the beloved creates a tension. And that's one of the core principles that I see in what Silverdale wrote down, is that there's a tension between these two diametrically opposed. Part of the reason that they're diametrically opposed is they operate differently. The mechanical self operates in a, as he puts it, a linear, sequential, let's say, logical sense. And the soul, or the non-phenomenal self, operates in a different manner altogether. It's like a well of grace, in a sense. That when you're in it, it's not a logical, therefore, principle. It's a direct sense of being. And so they're diametrically opposed, one because of the battle of the will of who's going to survive, but they're opposed just because they are by nature, fundamentally nature different. And that's just an interesting slant on that I hadn't seen before.
That's great. We've got more comments here. Sinhog,
okay.
To be awake is to be intention or attention. And then Silverdale, the resolution to the struggle of the sorcerers is to educate each of these two opposite forces so that each willingly and voluntarily not exercise the lawful refusal to submit. Think man and woman, and you're closer to the resolution. And Happy Mist, the awakening the machine to interrupt these historical episodes opens the light. Nice image. Awakening the machine to interrupt these historical episodes opens the light.
So how do we go about now? If the machine is operating along its own principles, then it will tend, the whole mechanism, the whole being then, is in a sleep posture. It goes to sleep. It's just running on its own fuel down its own train track, so to speak. It's okay. No problem with that, right? But there's no, how do you create then a meaningful, as the header in the paragraph said, what did it tell us? What did it suggest? It said that we must find a way to organize this war and make it profitable to our work.
Okay.
Did we begin to see a manner, a method here?
So I'd like to make an interjection. You're saying that the whole being would be asleep, and I'm not certain that the whole being is necessarily asleep. I think maybe the awakened part is running in the background, like a program that's in the background, but everything else is running over the desktop, and so you can't see it. So I'm looking at page 73. A human machine cannot live long without buffers. Either the contradictions must be isolated in some way, or the machine must be tucked safely away in the lunatic asylum, where the machine cannot exactly destroy its conscience in order to be free to seek its perpetual gratification. The emotional centrum, which is the activating factor of conscience, can be put to sleep by isolating the machine's contradictory states. So what I'm thinking about here is the buffers and the different parts that the buffers keep from being in communication one with the other, and that the wholeness of the being is something, at least initially, comprised of all of these different pieces. Well, to the non-phenomenal spherical self, it's always one thing. And these different, I think it would be a good practical discussion, if people are interested, to explore what are these buffers, how do these buffers operate, why do we have them, and can we move them?
So let me ask again, let me ask based on what you're saying. So what purpose does the buffer serve again?
Are you asking me what purpose they serve?
Yeah.
They keep the fragmentary identities from recognizing one another so that the machine is capable of sleeping.
Exactly. So if the buffers, first of all, do we have a sense that we have buffers? If we can begin to sense what our buffers might be, a technique for creating an ongoing tension might be to begin to buffer, to break down those buffers.
That's right. And Ginger Rogers said, makes a portal for the non-phenomenal by awakening the machine. Yes, at a practical level, what are the buffers? How do we recognize those buffers? How do we know when the buffers are operative, or can we know? And how do we begin to break them down or to challenge them in order to create this tension that it is the struggle of sorcerers?
Can we do this on our own?
I don't think we can. I believe that we need mirroring. I believe that we need, I think there's a lot of it that we can do on our own. I would go back to the fourth way, since there's people here who understand what that is. The fourth way is a book by, I believe, Ouspensky, and he was talking about the rule or the law of the octave, and during, in like on a piano, it goes half step, half step, whole step, half step, half step, half step, whole step, in the progression of tones. And he said all of the half step steps in our self-awakening we can do on our own, but the whole step, whole note steps require a jolt from the outside in order to help us awaken. And I've observed this in my work with people and their processes.
Okay.
Ginger Rogers, I've seen some people's machine go awake and they become quiet and still like they're going to sleep.
Yeah. In a... correct. That makes sense. I mean, it makes sense to me.
As in maybe as an arrested action, becoming suddenly self-aware and then watchful and becoming more identified with the neutral observer and less identified with the fragmentary identity that's playing out at the moment. And that's one of the processes that happens in beginning to break down the buffers.
It brings to mind a conversation I think we had before, was this idea that when the machine is awakened, its will drops. And suddenly it is subservient in a sense. It's subservient to the non-phenomenal self. And it's the act of awakening the machine that brings about a different change. But that's not your point. Your point is, how do we find our buffers, right?
How do we become self-aware, which is the question, central question in how do we wake up? We become aware. And what keeps us from being aware? Those buffers, which consist in part of, well, of ingrained habits, but also of traumas that have supported us in dissociating one part from the other, or what in psychology they call defenses, and then the identity becomes fragmented and we become unknown to ourselves because there's certain material that's just too hot or too scary for us to touch in with, or that's what we feel. And
yeah.
And then when we actually do it, sometimes the things that we've been running from that we're most terrified to view, that we're really, really defensive about it, when you just go underneath that defense into what it actually is, sometimes there's a peace or a calm that suddenly overtakes the machine at that point.
Did I hear somebody say they had a feeling about what a particular buffer they had?
Not at this point. Sinhog said, does the non-phenomenal self have an agenda or anything it wants to do? And I have a question. When we awaken, then does the tension between opposites go away? I think not. I think maybe in the awakened state, we're able to play them against each other with greater intensity in order to sustain our experience of the duality. I think that might be partly what being awake is. It's not necessarily an absence of tension, because reality in itself is made up of these opposing forces, and we become more aware of them.
Hey, T, I think I have an example of a buffer. It's something you and I went through in one of our sessions recently.
Okay.
Just because I work on issues with my narcissistic mother, and I was talking, you and I were discussing our relationship with you being my teacher, healer, friend, and I said that I both loved you and hated you, and as we explored the hatred of you, it was my wall. It was because I had an expectation that you would give me something and then take something back away from me. So isn't that a
that I would give you something and then demand something in return at some odd time without you having any control about what that demand might be?
Right. So what we were talking about is, like, I was projecting my pattern with my mother on you. So isn't that hatred I held, or that expectation that you were going to turn around and create this ungodly demand on me, is that a buffer? That, because once we broke through that, it's like all of a sudden I had this great calm come through.
Yeah, that's a good example. Not just the hatred, but maybe the terror that the hatred was protecting.
Okay. Okay, yeah, because
well,
that was a powerful session.
So what was it like on the other end of that when you became able to see that hatred and that terror were creating a reaction that didn't necessarily fit with what was happening in the moment? What happened inside you after that point in terms of your awareness or your sense of yourself?
I guess first it was almost a shock of realizing how deep that pattern is ingrained in me. in realizing how much it's interfering with me, the work, you know, our work and other relationships that I have. And then once we kind of broke through that and I sort of went through the shock of recognizing the pattern, then I felt relief. I also felt like I felt calm and so grateful that I had had just a moment of breaking through that pattern and getting to the other side of it.
Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
Or were you about to say something?
I was. I was going to say that, Diana, the... I lost it. I was going to say that the tension between your will to wake up in that moment and the will to sleep, as kind of demonstrated through the buffer and the hatred and fear that were coming up, that part was really resistant. That part was really defensive. And yet when you looked at it and you saw it, the moment of tension kind of peaked, and that was that jolt of awareness, kind of that lightning bolt of awareness. And that experience of awareness is powerful. And if you hadn't had the issue, then you wouldn't have had, or you hadn't looked at it, you hadn't done both of those things at the same time, you wouldn't have had that tension that created the awakening in that moment.
Right.
What were you going to say, David?
Just that last point. The concept of the buffer, on the one hand, so here's somebody before you, and you love the person, and you hate the person. You can't, both of those thoughts can't exist in your mind at the same time. So just mechanically, so the buffer is the thing that doesn't allow either of those things to see themselves at the same time. It's matter and antimatter coming together. So the buffer is simply a screen that keeps those two concepts aside. The concepts, that's how buffers work. So if you look and you say to somebody, "Well, what do you think about that person? I love them. What do you think about that person? I hate them. What? How could that be?" It can be because of a buffer sitting there. As you penetrate that incongruity, then the buffer starts to diminish. But guess what? That pattern will continue to, or potentially continue to exist, maybe not directly with, in this case, but it may find its way into another matter. And at that point, you have a little tool. A tool of observation to keep the buffer minimized, so to speak, to allow the tension to work. Okay? That's all.
So when you say that you cannot keep those two concepts cannot exist at the same time in your mind, that is generally the case unless we're really very much in the observer and watching both of those parts. However,
correct.
They can and they do exist in the body at the same time,
right?
Which is
right.
What a lot of muscle tension is. And as a body worker, then I observe all the time how the emotional conflict shows up as conflicting attempts to express, like maybe you want to use the example we're using already, maybe you want to hug someone and you want to hit them, and all of those muscles are activated at the same time, and they create a tension pattern. So when it comes to some of the earlier work in the book of observing the sequences of the tension patterns in the machine and where the energetics move through and activate the different muscles and organs, that is a very powerful practice for beginning to break down the buffers.
I just was wondering if anybody else had an example of a buffer that they discover and that they might be working with.
Silverdale has a comment. We can all read that while we're waiting to see if someone wants to come forward with another example.
Okay.
Silverdale, we are and always will be invol and always will be involuntary slaves to the fragmentation of our historical personality and the changeableness of our non-phenomenal self. Evolutionary transformation can occur by voluntarily blending these two forces to create the third force, which is the basis for reconciliation, neutralizing, harmonizing, and spiritualizing. To voluntarily blend these two forces requires that each, and then he trails off there. And since we're talking to Silver at the moment, I'd like maybe you can answer Silverdale. I'm interested in the changeableness of our non-phenomenal self. I generally see it as unchanging. Okay. To voluntarily blend these two forces requires that each be individually educated about itself, and then educated about the other, and then educated about the nature and potential of the third force.
Okay.
Oh, he said un I read that wrong. He said the unchangeable, non-phenomenal self. So I read that wrong. Evolutionary transformation can only occur by voluntarily blending these two forces to create the third force, which is the basis for reconciliation, neutralizing, harmonizing, and spiritualizing. To voluntarily blend these two forces requires that each be individually educated about itself, then educated about the other, and then educated about the nature and potential of the third force.
And is this what we're doing a little bit here in this course? And we're finding out about a, yeah, I mean that's what we're doing is we're trying to find out about how this whole thing works, and we're positing the question, well, maybe it's not just one thing. Maybe it's something else, and maybe there's a different category. Maybe it's two separate things, and these two separate things are working together in a certain way, and maybe they're even at war, and the being at war. And to continue his list, we also say that that the eventual reconciliation, don't forget that's a key issue here, is we call that process of redemption. And the idea is we're regaining ourselves there. We're redeeming it. We're redeeming ourselves from just being in the constant flow of the mechanicalness of it.
Silverdale says, exactly. We're using this course to educate ourselves. If you think education is expensive, try the alternative.
Well, we can see the alternative because we've been there. And there's a freshness in learning as we are right now. And there's a freshness in it, which I call, I feel more alive working in this manner. I feel like I'm using myself more. And I'm happy about doing that. It's a good thing. It feels like I'm going about it I'm in the right direction.
Sinhog said, I've met the alternative, and it is me. Oh.
I've met that alternative too, and it is you.
It's frightening, isn't it?
It is frightening. So I'm going to bring
Until we
up, I'm
break
just.
down the buffers, and then after it breaks down the buffers, and all of a sudden it's not as frightening as it used to be.
Well, and in some cases, when we break down the buffers, it's actually more frightening because there's less of a place to hide or rest. Some people use the word hide. I keep getting a feeling that there's another buffer out there that somebody wants to talk about.
Yeah, the need to hide is another buffer. I think it, I don't know, in my experience, it gets peaceful when you get underneath the buffers. I feel like there's somebody else, too, who has a buffer they'd like to talk about.
I'll share one. Maybe it's me that I'm thinking of.
Ginger Rogers, it's more frightening when the buffers are down.
That's right, it is. I'll share one that is frightening to me that works in me almost constantly. But you can interrupt me if more comments come. And it's like I find myself slavishly seeking the approval of others in virtually any environment I'm in. That I, let's say I meet somebody for the first time. Maybe not all of me is in this process, but maybe. And I want them to like me, approve me, you know, not eat me in some cases, but. You know, so there's this desire. At the same time, I can see when I'm, then let's say that process stops for some reason. I go out of the room, they go out of the room, and I think of myself and I'm disgusted that that's what I do. And so at that moment, this thing starts happening. And sometimes I push the button, and I can see myself like a little puppet seeking approval of the other, like just a, they wound up the machine like the little wind-up monkey on the street that you see the vendor selling. That's what I am in those instances. And when I punch the button, and the buffer is gone, it's, as Ginger Rogers said, it's frightening because it just goes.
After it's gone, though, do you still feel as vulnerable as you did in the process of coming to it? Or do you get, I get to a point of surrender at that point where it's almost like the worst has already happened, and then there's this acceptance that comes in, that kind of like a cool feeling that floods in and relaxes everything at that point, because there's no nothing to defend anymore. It's like I'm already, it's kind of like I'm down on the wet cement, but there's nowhere further to fall.
But my purpose, yeah, but yes, I do know that point and that position. And in fact, one of the ways, because we have to look at how can we see these things in ourselves, right? You know, this, how can we view that? For me, a primary way of noticing how it begins to operate, to use a phrase you use, was you use the muscle tensions in the body. Well, the muscle tensions in my body that are the key to me when that monster starts to show its head is a certain tension that comes up either in my face or in certain different parts of my head. So when I notice that, I can see, aha, there you go. There it goes again, marching down its toy soldier path. Now, the key for me sometimes, though, is the tension of watching myself helplessly. And some buffers, sometimes there's no behavior to change. You're just like that. That's when the tension is most profitable. There's nothing like, this is it.
Like a fly in a spider web.
You're caught. And you're caught by your own observation, and the buffer ain't there anymore, and the spiders may be coming to eat you. And you're right. Maybe at that moment it's just a matter of surrender.
I don't know.
And
I
then.
think it is. Ginger Rogers is saying moments of freedom. And I do think there's an experience underneath the
Yes.
fear, because the buffers, I think, are largely defense. And when we get to the point where we just don't have the energy or even the will to defend ourselves for that particular moment, then the field just kind of opens up. And I think sometimes we want to view the mechanical part as the monster, but sometimes it's just a little boy, or sometimes it's just a little girl, and it's scared and it's trying to pretend like it's a really big monster because it's scared. And as soon as you realize that the worst has already happened and you may have been totally rejected and there's nothing you can do and you just accept it and surrender, and then, go back into a different place that's much broader, and there are more personality fragments available at worst, and maybe a sliver of the non-phenomenal self at best.
But sometimes, yes, there's no question that even placing the power of the will of attention on such an activity, it awakens the machine and it awakens the possibility of just of moving into it. And the power of the tension at that moment creates an ability to awaken in a certain way that's quite unique. But it's also working with maintaining a certain portion of the tension. Sometimes willingly walking into the tension, thus creating a situation whereby you've created a way to organize the war between the Prince of Darkness and the Prince of Light to make it profitable for our work. So sometimes allowing the tension is precisely what I want to do. Do you get, do I have to get, do you get stuck there? Do you have to get stuck? Absolutely not. Is there a way out? You bet there is.
I'm just looking at this sentence. That side of ourselves which we believe we know best and which seems to us to be our only friend is actually our deadliest enemy in the work.
Doesn't that, in a certain way, doesn't that in a certain way intuitively make sense that that's the case? Our old chummy old friend, our old good buddy that we hang out
The
with.
Prince of Light, the part that we know best, that we identify with. The
Our
part that.
journey.
Hmm?
Yeah, no, good. I'm sorry.
The part that we are most habitual within. That's why it's so familiar, because it's there so much of the time and we can kind of take it for granted. That part is the part that I think, that's the part that goes trotting through life without seeing the buffers.
I like that phrase, trotting through life.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. Just trot away.
It's the trot.
So, if that other masked stranger who's out there trying to wanting to share a buffer doesn't come forth, are we at a place where we want to move on, or how are we doing?
No more comments at the moment. It might be a good time for us to change the tape and then move into our next chapter.
Well, our handy dandy tape changer isn't around at the moment, but so we might have. No, we're short an hour. I mean, but we're about to go to the next chapter, so. Yeah, we go to an hour.